put it somewhere. Okay. That's my pointer. I have it here. Okay. I'm more comfortable walking around. Can everybody hear me like this? Can you hear me in the back? I don't need the mic, right? Do I need the mic?
No.
If you say so, then I'll use the mic. So I'm going to talk about DKA and hyperosmolar state, and I'd like to discuss them together because they're really overlapping and it is an artificial thing to completely separate these two. I'm going to go over a lot of basic stuff that you all know, but just for completion, okay? And I'm going to run through these things that are very familiar to everybody pretty quickly. So we start out with the clinical presentation and then talk a little bit about the biochemistry and the treatment, okay? Please interrupt me anytime if you have questions. I want to make this interactive as much as possible. So here you see the presenting symptoms. Nausea, vomiting, polyuria, polydipsia, weakness, anorexia, abdominal pain, visual disturbances, somnolence. Why do they have visual disturbance? What is the reason for visual disturbance?
Hyperglycemia
is the reason. Okay, hyperglycemia. But what is the mechanism? Refractory index change in the lens. Because the lens, there's a polyol pathway. Glucose gets taken up and gets converted to fructose. And fructose can't diffuse back. And therefore, water pulls into the lens. And you get blurring because of that. There's another reason of blurring in diabetics. What would that be? Retinopathy. If you have macular edema, you get blurring of vision. That's a much more serious problem, of course. But typically, this is one of the most common disturbances in people with uncontrolled diabetes, is blurring of vision, polyuria, polydipsia. The others are self-explanatory, I think. And the signs, of course, signs of dehydration, tachycardia, hypotension, dehydration, hypothermia. So the temperature is important to remember that uncontrolled diabetes, you do not have to be febrile to be infected. So we always have to consider infection as a possible problem. And, of course, hypothermia can be there, and they have sepsis and so on. They typically have a warm, dry skin. They have Kussmaul respiration, they have lethargy or coma in the most advanced cases, and with DKA, the fruity odor. So I'm just going to ask, what's the difference between somebody who is short of breath from running, or from COPD, or from CHF, versus somebody who has Kussmaul respiration? What's the difference? The respiratory center adapts in a different way to acidosis as compared to hypoxia. In hypoxia, you get tachypnea. And in acidosis, you get deep respiration. It may not be all that fast. And therefore, you have to look at the patient, look at the diaphragm, look at move. You see them take deep in and out respiration. That's a classical. So you have an increased tidal volume. Okay? Fruity odor, you all know what it's from, right? What's a fruity odor from in DKA?
Acetone.
Is acetone a ketone body? No. Why not? It's a spontaneous decarboxylation product of acetoacetate. So it does not have the carboxyl group, therefore it's not a ketone body. It's just spontaneous degradation product of acetoacetate. But it can help us identify the patient if you don't have too many other odors in the room, like on 5 South. Any other question to this? No. Here you show a very old study showing pH, what happens to the respiratory minute volume. Goes up, and actually when goes up as pH goes down, and if it goes down a lot, and it actually goes down because you get weakness of respiratory muscles and you get respiratory problems. You can't adapt any further. Almost all patients who come in with DKA or uncontrolled diabetes have a reason, a precipitating factor. And there are many as listed here. The most common things are infection and our omission to take antidiabetic medications. So infection can be any infection as listed here, and I won't go through all of them. I want to just stress there's one specific infection that is only seen in DKA. It's called mucormycosis. So you have to check the turbinates. You have to check the sinuses. Specifically look for that. It can spread to the brain, as you probably know, and can be life-threatening. So we need to recognize that in patients with type 1 diabetes who have DKA. The other ones, there are some problems how to recognize these infections, and we'll get into this a little bit more. Any stress, including emotional stress and trauma, can also cause insulin resistance and uncontrolled diabetes. So you have all these things, including some endocrine diseases, and I have a separate slide for drugs. And now, not uncommonly, we see patients on psychotropic drugs that get uncontrolled diabetes, even those patients who didn't know they'd have diabetes. And the mechanism for diabetes or worsening of diabetes in these patients is not fully understood. Part of it may just be that most of them gain weight and have much more severe insulin resistance as they stay on these agents. But we still don't really understand why they get such severe, sometimes severe impairment of their glycemic control. Of course, steroids, immunosuppressants can cause it, as you well know. The others are actually quite rare. Everybody's on beta blockers, and yet very few people get into ketoacidosis from this. So this is based on case reports, and I wouldn't pay too much attention to this. Diuretics do not cause impairment of glycemic control if you prevent hypokalemia. The way diuretics can impair glycemic control, both loop diuretics and thiazide diuretics, is by hypokalemia. Hypokalemia because insulin secretion is regulated by closing of the potassium channel. And if you have hypokalemia, this mechanism doesn't work as well, and you can get inhibition of insulin secretion. So it's not due to the drug itself. It's due to the sequelae of taking the drug if you have hypokalemia. So if you avoid hypokalemia, there's no problem with diuretics in diabetics. Anticonvulsants. Dilantin inhibits insulin secretion. I've seen patients get loaded up and go to hyperosmolar state with glucose of 1,000. So keep in mind, when you load somebody up, especially if they're known to be diabetic, some of them will just, because you have profound inhibition of insulin secretion in some patients. Diazoxide is used in patients with insulinomas. It specifically inhibits insulin secretion. Again, any question? Please speak up. So this is from up to date, more or less, in terms of what we currently think, what the pathogenesis is of the two syndromes, which are overlapping but somewhat distinct. So type 1 diabetics have absolute insulin deficiency by the time they present with DKA. This leads to inhibition to the lack of inhibition of lipolysis, because insulin at very low concentration inhibits lipolysis, and the free fatty acids that are released from fat cells are the driving force for ketoacidosis. They go to the liver, and in the liver, they are in the absence of insulin, they're converted to ketones. We'll get into that a little bit more. So that's the main reason why, in the absence of maybe you can shut this thing off. I don't know if it has anything to do with it. You want to check whether. Slight break. I'm going to see if the NCB people are there and want to listen in.
Can you see us? NCB, can you hear us?
No, he cannot.
How does he hear us if he said no?
Anyway, they have a pretty good turnout over there.
Yeah. Can you see me?
No mic.
Oh, no mic?
It says no mic.
Yeah? We're good?
Am I too close to? Can you hear me? Okay, I'm going to have to stay sent here then.
Dr. Schubert is standing on the other side of the camera, so you just have to listen. We're not going to see him, okay?
Sure.
I'm putting it on so that we can continue the lecture. Is that okay? I'm putting it back on the lecture.
Well, I'm afraid you're going to have to do without my image, okay? So the lecture's in progress, and I'm going to continue as soon as the slides are up. Oh, I have to stand here so I can't. So we're talking about the pathogenesis of the syndrome of DKA and hyperosmolar syndrome. So the difference between type 1 and type 2 diabetes is that the type 1, in fully blown type 1 diabetes, you have loss of beta cells due to autoimmune destruction and no more insulin. And in the absence of insulin, if the patient doesn't take their insulin, they will get ketoacidosis because of lipolysis, flux of free fatty acids into the bloodstream, and ketone production by the liver. If the patient has some insulin but doesn't take enough or has some other reason for precipitating factors that are listed in the center of the slide, namely increased catecholamines, cortisol, growth hormone, glucagon, because of various precipitating factors, which causes insulin resistance and therefore a worsening of the type 2 diabetes, they will typically have some insulin left and therefore will not completely unblock the inhibition of lipolysis by insulin. So therefore, they start out with hyperosmolar state by stimulating proteolysis and glycogenolysis, predominantly through the counter-regulatory hormones that are increased. Is this
around 5, around 6, 6:30?
Are they talking to me or somebody else? Okay, I'm just gonna go on. Okay. You know how to shut it off? Would be helpful. It's very distractive.
NCB, can you hear us? Can you not say anything in the middle of the lecture? We hear you.
We don't even know if this is them.
We can hear you.
Can you hear us?
Yeah.
We can hear you also, so you guys have to stop talking.
Oh, okay. There's nobody here.
So then shut off the machine, please.
Okay.
But it may be coming from somewhere else. I don't know. All right, we continue to struggle with the technical setup here. So precipitating factors in both types of diabetics, the precipitating factors affect proteolysis and glycogenolysis. Proteolysis provides gluconeogenic substrates that lead to gluconeogenesis in the liver in the absence of insulin, and the end result is hyperglycemia. So you have increased proteolysis, gluconeogenesis, and glycogenolysis, hyperglycemia. Lipolysis also provides glycerol, and it's another gluconeogenic substrate. So when you have hyperglycemia, then you get glucosuria, because once you exceed the renal threshold of glucose, and you get osmotic diuresis, loss in water and electrolytes, dehydration, decreased GFR, hyperosmolality, vicious cycle. That's why you can go, if it's unrecognized, particularly in new onset type 2 diabetics, we not uncommonly see them come in with very high blood glucose because they don't know they have diabetes. They keep drinking often sugar-containing fluids and make it worse, but they drink enough fluids to not get all that dehydrated that they walk in sometimes with a blood sugar of 1,500, and they're not necessarily obtunded. Okay. So, however, in patients with type 2 diabetes, they can sometimes also get ketoacidosis. Why is that? I'll get to that in a moment. Slides are not completely. So, let's just first show you the remind you of the biochemistry in the hepatocyte. Glucagon is the major player in turning on ketogenesis and gluconeogenesis. So cyclic AMP is increased because glucagon is a G-protein coupled receptor that is linked to adenosine cyclase. So cyclic AMP goes up in the cell, turns on protein kinase A, which inhibits PFK2, and therefore you inhibit fructose PFK1 here, so you reverse the glycolysis to gluconeogenesis. And I won't go into all the details about the biochemistry. So this shows the main process of ketogenesis. And that is when glucagon is present and insulin is not present, again in the hepatocyte, fatty acids will be converted to fatty acyl-CoA, which normally in the presence of insulin would be used to synthesize triglycerides, but in the absence of insulin, because of the activation of the transporter for fatty acyl-CoA, they go into the mitochondria. And I'll show you a little bit other slide where that how that works exactly. So they get transported in the mitochondria and got oxidized to beta-hydroxybutyrate and acetoacetate. These two are the ketone bodies. They're both acids, and they're interconvertible by an NADH-dependent process. And depending on how much reducing equivalents there are, the ratio can change. And that's important. Why is that important? When we measure ketones in the blood, which one do we measure? We only measure acetoacetate, not beta-hydroxybutyrate. The normal ratio between these two is 2:1, more or less. If you have a lot of NADH around, you can get significant shift into this direction. You have a ratio of beta-hydroxybutyrate to acetoacetate that can be as high as 10:1 or even higher. So when you check your plasma for ketones, it may not fully tell you the severity of the acidosis because you're not looking at beta-hydroxybutyrate. And then when the patient gets better, this gets converted back to acetoacetate and the ketones get worse as the patient gets better. So to not get confused about that, my recommendation is to not bother measuring ketones once you have established that your metabolic acidosis is due to ketoacidosis. The initial one, you need to know. But to follow the patient, you don't need to measure ketones every day. You're just going to get confused by it. So just don't do it. That's my recommendation. Okay? So NADH is generated in metabolism of various things. It's a good question. I should know this. And I don't recall at the moment. Metabolism of alcohol, for example, generates NADH. But there are other conditions. Hypoxia will generate NADH. Okay, let me go on. So this gives you just a summary of what happens in the liver cell in the presence, in the absence of insulin and presence of glucagon and other counter-regulatory hormones. You have increased glycogenolysis, increased gluconeogenesis. Both of them raise the glucose. And here's shown the CPT1, the carnitine phosphotransferase, which is a mechanism by which fatty acyl-CoA enters the mitochondria. That's sort of key to what happens. So insulin activates acetyl-CoA carboxylase, which converts acetyl-CoA to malonyl-CoA. And malonyl-CoA is an inhibitor of CPT1, so therefore, in the presence of insulin, fatty acyl-CoA doesn't go into mitochondria. It is used for triglyceride synthesis. If insulin is missing, then you have decreased malonyl-CoA, you have activation of CPT1 and entry of fatty acyl-CoA into the mitochondria. Ketones. So that's the mechanism. Ketones are acids, and therefore you get acidosis, but they're not all bad. They can be used as fuel in muscle and in heart muscle. Both beta-hydroxybutyrate and acetoacetate can be taken up by muscle. And in fact, this would generate NADH, as you can see here. And you can then use it as fuel and burn it in the citric acid cycle. So that's one way by which the body will try to get rid of ketones. The other one is excreted in the urine. Ketones are effectively excreted in the urine. So that's why you have high ketones in the urine when you have ketoacidosis. Now let me just make one important point. Ketones by themselves do not make ketoacidosis. Anybody who is starving is entitled to have ketones in their urine because insulin falls during starvation. And even some plasma ketones can be detected in starved patients. So to say just because somebody had positive ketones, they have ketoacidosis, is wrong. I see it all the time. Patients are discharged with DKA just because they had ketones. DKA requires that they have an anion gap metabolic acidosis, and it's due to ketones. That is ketoacidosis. Okay? So now I come back to the point, why do patients with type 2 diabetes sometimes present with ketoacidosis, even though typically they have enough insulin to suppress lipolysis, so therefore they shouldn't get ketoacidosis? And this is due to the phenomenon called leukotoxicity and lipotoxicity. Patients who have uncontrolled diabetes have obviously elevated glucose, but they also have typically abnormal lipids. Insulin is an activator of lipoprotein lipase. So if insulin is low, then you have increased triglycerides often because they're not broken down. You also have changes in the liver production of VLDL. I won't go into this, but lipid abnormalities are very common in uncontrolled diabetes. So you have both glucose and abnormal lipid levels, particularly triglycerides, VLDL, and they can be toxic to the beta cell and to tissues in general. So glucose toxicity is best understood. So I won't talk more about lipotoxicity, and except for telling you that it can cause problems also and is implicated in this process. But glucotoxicity has been very well studied. In the short term, there's reversible inhibition of glucose uptake and utilization in insulin-responsive target tissues. Those are muscle, liver, and fat. In fact, they're only muscle and fat, I'm sorry. The liver has insulin receptors, but the uptake of glucose into the liver is not dependent on insulin. But in muscle and in fat, there's a minor metabolism, and excessive glucose enters the cell. A portion, most of it goes to glycolysis and so on, and glycogen formation and so on. But there's a minor pathway that goes to N-acetylglucosamine. And N-acetylglucosamine can inhibit glucose uptake in muscle and fat. And that's a short-term effect of glucose toxicity, if you wish. If you have more prolonged elevation of glucose in patients who are not realizing that they have diabetes and go on for weeks, they can get, at the tail end, glucose toxicity involving the beta cell inhibiting insulin secretion. And if that is sufficient to shut off insulin secretion almost completely, which usually happens at the tail end of their presentation after they have been running around with high glucose levels, then the insulin levels can be so low that then now they're producing ketones also. And that's the mechanism for type 2 diabetics presenting with ketoacidosis. So it's due to glucose toxicity. We know that because if you normalize their glucose, their insulin levels come back up and they often don't require insulin for treatment of their diabetes. I want to mention briefly also that long-term glucose and lipotoxicity play a role in the loss of beta cells that progresses with time, also in type 2 diabetes. Diabetes is a progressive disease. So there's a combination in type 2 diabetes of insulin resistance that is genetically determined and by exogenous factors, primarily diet and weight gain. And they have an impaired ability of their beta cell to upregulate insulin secretion sufficiently to overcome that insulin resistance. That's the definition of type 2 diabetes. But as they progress, it becomes more and more difficult to treat them because they're losing beta cells. And one of the mechanisms by which they're losing beta cells is glucose toxicity and lipotoxicity. So poorly controlled diabetics have a faster loss of beta cells because of the poor control of their diabetes. So back to the patient. It's essential to rule out infection. Everybody presents with this uncontrolled diabetes syndrome. You have to look for meningeal signs. You look for necrotizing nasal turbidites, as already mentioned. If necessary, get the appropriate imaging studies. Consider these things with abdominal pain. The problem is here, in DKA particularly, patients will have, in the absence of pancreatitis, elevated pancreatic enzymes, both amylase and lipase. They don't have to have ketoacidosis and will have often elevated enzymes. So you need to look more closely and not just look at the enzymes, obviously. You have to obtain a chest X-ray and check the urine sediment in every patient. So you all know that hyperosmolality can be measured and calculated. And first thing is we want to know, do we have an osmolar gap? This is important because we want to know whether what we measure accounts for what we see. So we measure glucose. We know the glucose is high. And we have an iodine gap, and so we think the patient has DKA, or we don't have an iodine gap, the patient has hyperosmolar state. So we calculate their osmolality, which by the formula that everybody should know, twice the sodium times glucose plus over 18 plus BUN over 2.8. And then you measure by freezing point depression, send the serum or plasma for osmolality measurement, and you want to know that there's not a big difference between the measured and the calculated. If there's a gap, then there's something else going on. The patient may have taken alcohol, the patient may have taken ethylene glycol, the patient may have taken something else that raises osmolality that's not picked up in our typical electrolyte measurements and so on. The patient may have lactic acidosis. So keep that in mind. The osmolar gap will tell you that the glucose is sufficient to account for the hyperosmolar state or not. And what's important for the patient is not the absolute osmolality, because BUN doesn't crosses freely into cells. So there is an equilibration across the cell membrane. So it doesn't contribute to the osmotic gradient between cells and extracellular fluid. BUN does not. So for the effective serum osmolality, we leave out the BUN and just look at 2 times sodium plus glucose over 18. And that, if that's greater than 320, that is called hyperosmolar state. Typically, serum osmolality is 290 to 300 total osmolality. So if the effective osmolality is greater than 320, then you have a severely hyperosmolar patient. Sodium should be corrected, because as glucose goes up, you pull in water into the extracellular fluid and you lower your sodium. There are various formulas. I don't care which one you use, but you should be aware that you can correct the sodium, and that gives you an idea how severely the patient is dehydrated. Because if the corrected sodium comes back high, then you know the patient is profoundly dehydrated. If the corrected sodium is normal, then the dehydration is not as severe. So obviously, metabolic acidosis is determined by anion gap. And I won't get into complex mixed acid-base disorders. That would carry us too far away. I'm just going to tell you that typical DKA, of course, you need to have an anion gap. This just gives you an idea about what typical numbers, levels are in patients presenting with the extreme forms, either DKA or hyperosmolar state. It's from an old study in 1971, but it still holds up pretty well. So these are the average levels in these various parameters from patients from a cohort of patients presenting either with DKA or hyperosmolar state without ketoacidosis. So typically, what's different is that in hyperosmolar state, the glucose tends to be much higher. Why is that? In order for your glucose to go above 600, you need to have a fall in GFR. You can, if you drink lots of fluids and even sugar-containing fluid, as long as you maintain a good GFR, you cannot get your glucose up above 600. The kidney has a tremendous ability to excrete glucose. So only when the GFR falls because of dehydration, because of volume contraction, does the glucose go above 600. So therefore, the hyperosmolar patient typically can go much higher than 600. DKA patients tend to get sick from acidosis before their glucose goes very high, because in acidosis they get nausea, vomiting, and they come into the hospital before they have had a chance to really let the glucose rise so far. That's why there's a difference in glucose. That's helpful to look at somehow. Serum sodium, I'm not sure if this is corrected. No, this is even the non-corrected, I think, is much higher in a hyperosmolar state. The potassium is higher in DKA. Why is the potassium higher in DKA? Because in acidosis, you have, at presentation, often hyperkalemia, even though the patient have total body potassium depletion. Why is that?
The hydrogen is going into the cell and the potassium is coming out from the cell.
It's one mechanism is that, yes, that there's transcellular exchange of the body tries to protect the extracellular milieu. So if you have acidosis, the cells take up hydrogen ions and give out their major cation, which is potassium. That's one reason. The other reason is because of what's called solute drag, that when you have high osmolality in extracellular fluid, you pull water out of cells and the major cation potassium comes along with it. So that's solute drag. And the third mechanism is if your kidney can't excrete it all, then if the rate of production, no. Forget about that. I mean, potassium is high because typically the kidney cannot conserve potassium very well. That's why you lose a lot. But especially if you have decreased GFR, then you can't get rid of the potassium that way either. So hyperkalemia is common in acidosis. It's not common in just hyperosmolar state, but may be present there too. Of course, the bicarb is lower by definition. pH is lower by definition. The PCO2 is lower in the blood gas because patients with DKA tend to want to blow off their CO2. Anion gap, by definition, serum osmolality is much higher in hyperosmolar state. BUN is higher, creatinine is higher. Ketones can be positive in both, but typically serum ketones are higher in DKA. So this is all pretty intuitive. Yeah. This is the measured sodium. So it tells you that it's already elevated. So if you correct the sodium, I'm pretty sure it's a measured sodium here. This would be significantly higher. May have sodium maybe around 150, 160, close to 160 range. So in hyperosmolar, they're typically much more profoundly dehydrated. That's, even though they have high glucose, their glucose is not low, but it's still high because the actual glucose is much higher still. Does it answer your question? So and here you can see what their deficits typically are. So in DKA, 6 liters, in hyperosmolar state, 9 liters of water deficit, or milligrams per kilograms. So you can see the principal depletion is water. You have, of course, electrolyte deficiency, also sodium, potassium, chloride, phosphate, magnesium, calcium, but they are much less significant than the water deficit. Except the potassium deficit, you have to know that every single patient with uncontrolled diabetes has lost potassium, because the kidney doesn't have a good mechanism to conserve sodium, potassium. What are poor prognostic factors in indicators? Of course, comorbidities and age. Advanced age, patients with more severe acidosis, patients who are hypotensive, the most severely dehydrated patients, marked hyperosmolality, high BUN, and associated diseases. This is pretty intuitive, so I won't go further into this. I have to keep track of my time a little bit so I don't go over too much. We started late, so I'm going to go over a little bit. So what are the treatment considerations? If you know what the predisposing cause is, which is present in 80%, you have to deal with that, of course. We typically put everybody on antibiotics who come in with DKA or hyperosmolar state until we have ruled out infection, because we don't know. They don't have fever. They may have a white count from the stress or may have a white count from infection, so it can be difficult to know right away. So typically we put them on antibiotics, and then while we are working up whether or not they're infected. Every patient, adult patient, should have an ECG because they may have silent myocardial infarction. Important consideration is initially we want to stabilize the hemodynamic situation. So we give, even though they are water depleted more than sodium depleted, we give normal saline initially to prevent, to stabilize the intravascular situation. IV insulin is the preferred mode of administration. Turns out you can give it any old way if you know what you're doing. The only way to give it, let's say you're out somewhere where you don't have the ability to give it. If you give intravenous fluids, you can give intramuscular insulin. You can give once an hour 10 units of IV insulin. You get pretty much the same effect, but it's much easier to titrate, of course, if you have the ability to monitor and give it as a constant IV infusion. And, of course, that protocol is used in most sites that have the ability to do it. Subcutaneous is not recommended because the patient may be in shock and may have poor tissue perfusion, and you set up a depot under the skin, and as they get better, then all of a sudden all this insulin gets absorbed and they become severely hypoglycemic. And initially they don't respond to the insulin. So subcutaneous is not recommended. And recently people have looked at whether it makes any difference whether you, for example, make a bolus, load somebody up with insulin, and then start the drip, or just start the drip and it makes no difference in outcome. Potassium depletion in all patients, I always stress that, and I did already. So obviously the prevention is a long-term goal of management, and bicarbonate administration, I'll get into a little bit, is rarely indicated. Other treatment considerations, if the patient has any kind of blood loss and needs type and cross match, blood cultures, aspirate. Often patients that are comatose may have, particularly with type 1 diabetes, may have distended gastric distension, and they're at risk for aspiration. So you want to put an NG tube down if you percuss their epigastrium and find that they have a distended stomach. You want to decompress that. If you can't monitor the output, you need to, by the patient's stateness of alertness and cooperation, then you need to put obviously a Foley down. And measurement, And of course you give oxygen if necessary and keep the patient NPO at this stage. So the three components of treatment are fluids, insulin, and potassium.
Sure.
Yes.
Can I?
Yes.
You were talking about routine antibiotics, right? For every patient who comes in with DKA?
Unless you're absolutely sure the patient has didn't take their medication, take their insulin, and they come in, and it's so obvious that there's nothing else going on. But typically, in most patients, initially, the cause is not clear. And it's the best way is to just assume they're infected until you have ruled it out. I think I'm saying that you do that as they come into the emergency room. They're sick. They're even though they're not febrile. If you suspect infection, let's say, I wouldn't make it 100%. All right, let's not get hung up on that. If you feel confident the patient's not infected, then you don't give them antibiotics. I can live with that. So the three mainstays of treatment are fluids, insulin, and potassium. And fluids, people are typically too hesitant to give enough fluids. That's a key part. Because I told you, between 6 and 9 liters deficit of fluid, even an elderly patient in a hyperosmolar state, you can save their life by giving them rapidly lots of fluid. I know people are afraid that they go into CHF and they go into pulmonary edema. You just have to watch the frail elderly patient much more closely. But typically, the recommendation is to give 2 to 3 liters in the first 3 hours. Most papers suggest, most reviews suggest to give 1 liter in the first half hour. I mean, in the first hour you should give like a liter. I mean, you really pour it in. Once the blood pressure is stable and the patient is having a good urine output, then you can switch to half normal saline to replace predominantly their water. Another key thing about fluids is once you reach blood sugar of 250, do not try to lower it any further at that point in the first 24 hours, because the brain cannot adjust. The extra fluid in the CSF cannot adjust quickly enough, and the brain cannot adjust quickly enough to equilibrate with the extracellular fluid. You have idiocytic osmoles. It's still sort of a vague term, but the CNS is hyperosmolar, and if you lower the extracellular fluid levels too quickly, you can get osmolality too quickly. You can get influx of water into the brain, you can get herniation and death of the patient. This happens primarily in kids. We fortunately don't see it very much in adults. But I've come to the ICU in July and somebody presented a patient with DKA, and they're very happy that within 6 hours the glucose was down to 100. I told them, you're lucky you didn't kill the patient. You're supposed to stop at 250 and hang up glucose, continue the insulin, but give glucose and maintain the glucose around 250 for the first 24 hours. That's key. You don't want to have disequilibrium too quickly between the brain and the extracellular fluid. Insulin, typically you need about 10 units per hour. And we only use short-acting insulin, either ultra-short or regular. It doesn't really matter. And then you monitor how fast the glucose drops. Keep in mind, the first drop in patients that have glucose above 600 is due to an increase in GFR. So if somebody has a glucose of 1,000, it can get very quickly down to 600. And that's not due to insulin, but it's due to increasing GFR, because the kidney now excretes all this glucose. Once they're on 600, the expected rate of fall should be about 100 milligram per deciliter per hour. You can't get much, can't get more, even if you saturate all the insulin receptors. So therefore, if you don't get that expected fall, then you should increase your insulin, because the patient has some reason to be more insulin resistant than the typical patient. So you need to monitor what's going on. That's the key thing. Okay? Once the acidosis, once the anion gap closes, then he can slow down the rate of infusion. And the other key thing about insulin is don't stop the drip and send them to the floor. Because by the time they get to the floor, they have recurrence of ketoacidosis. The half-life of insulin is 3 to 5 minutes of intravenous insulin. If you stop the drip, insulin is gone. And glucose starts rising immediately. You need to give intermediate-acting insulin subcutaneously before you turn the drip off. An hour or two before you turn the drip off, you give some insulin. Maybe even more than 2 hours. Potassium is absolute key. The literature recommends to give potassium even if, as soon as the potassium is below 6. I think most of the house staff doesn't dare to do anything like this. But it turns out a potassium below 6 doesn't cause any problem. People are worried about hyperglycemia. Start giving K-exalate. People with 5.5, stop the ACE inhibitor. It's not necessary. Somebody in the clinic has a K of 5.5, it's on an ACE inhibitor. You think they need it for kidney protection because they have diabetic nephropathy or other kidney disease. Maybe add a thiazide diuretic or something. Add a potassium-wasting diuretic rather than stopping the ACE inhibitor. As long as the potassium doesn't go above 6, or if it reaches 6, then you have to do something. But below 6, it doesn't cause any problems. It doesn't cause arrhythmia below 6 or asystole or anything like that. And I've checked this with nephrologists. They agree with me. So you can give potassium right away, but certainly you should give it as soon as the potassium is near the normal range. Because every patient is potassium depleted. And they recommend to give as much as 80 milligrams per hour for if you start giving it, if you give it while the potassium is hypokalemic. So most house staff do not dare to give that much potassium. But the literature says you should. Just keep in mind, potassium, potassium, potassium. So obviously we monitor the patient, mental status, vital signs, body weight. Well, body weight is a euphemistic goal because you won't get the nurses to take the patient out of bed and put them on a monitor. But it would be a nice way to see that they're actually getting their fluid repleted. But that's wishful thinking, let's say. But those obvious things you have to monitor. And if they have abnormal EKG, you have to monitor that, of course. You monitor their lab values. So the key thing is to monitor the glucose to see that what you're doing is lowering it, that their potassium is not falling too much, that their anion gap starts closing, that their pre-renal acidemia that's typically there improves. Ketones can actually interfere with the measurement of creatinine. So often patients with ketoacidosis will have a creatinine that's elevated that's not due to decreased GFR necessarily. So they both should get better as you improve the ketoacidosis. Phosphate and magnesium, it's said here that you should monitor that, and I don't necessarily agree with it because magnesium is fine, but phosphate, even if their phosphate goes low, we don't typically replete it because nobody has shown that makes a difference, an outcome. Of course, maybe every 24 hours, if the phosphate is very, very low, less, you know, 1 or below, then you want to give some phosphate. Maybe give some of the potassium as K-phosphate. They say here, urine ketones to monitor. I don't recommend to do it as often, but it gives you a good idea how much ketones the patient still has floating around. Ideally, we want to have the patient on an insulin drip until the urine ketones are clear, because then you know you have completely converted all the ketones and gotten rid of them. But that can take 2 or 3 days. And therefore, because of shortage of monitored beds and so on, patients typically get kicked out before and get taken off the drip. So that's also wishful thinking. calcium and hematocrit as indicated. So we monitor the therapy, how much fluid we give, and what the output is, insulin units per hour, potassium, how much we give. We want to record all this stuff. This is pretty obvious. So as you give fluids and you give insulin, you reverse the situation in the hepatocyte, which is the major target for this whole problem. Namely, you shut off glucagon, insulin shuts off glucagon, and insulin now turns on PFK2, so now you go to glycolysis. So glucose goes into the TCA cycle and can be used as fuel in the liver, and can be used after it's converted glucose 6-phosphate to glycogen formation. So as I alluded to earlier, insulin turns on acetyl-CoA carboxylase. So you convert acetyl-CoA that comes through the citric acid cycle as the end product of glycolysis. Now, in the presence of insulin, you convert acetyl-CoA to malonyl-CoA. You shut off CPT1. Fatty acyl-CoA can no longer enter the mitochondria and gets used for triglyceride synthesis. So you convert from gluconeogenesis to glycolysis, from glycogenolysis to glycogen formation, and you inhibit ketone production. Anabolic cascade. So a few words about the adverse effects of severe acidosis. And that gets into the question whether or not we give bicarb. If you have very severe acidosis, you can actually get impaired cardiac contractility. You can get decreased response of the arterioles to vasoconstrictors, catecholamines and angiotensin II. And you can get inhibition of respiration, as I mentioned at the beginning. But on the other hand, we have to keep in mind that there are potential adverse effects of bicarb administration. When you give bicarb, you push glucose into cells. And therefore, and potassium into cells. And therefore, you can get hypokalemia more severe. In addition, there's a theoretical consideration that you shift the dissociation curve of hemoglobin so that tissue oxygen delivery is impaired. This is theoretical because nobody has really in vivo shown that this is a significant problem. But the main problem is hypokalemia is more common. So we try not to give bicarbonate unless the patient is very severely acidotic because the insulin and fluid administration corrects the acidosis. You don't need bicarb in most patients. So who do we give it to? If the pH is less than 7, if the bicarb is less than 5, if the potassium is very high, if the patient is refractory to fluid replacement in terms of blood pressure, if there's severely impaired LV function, if there's respiratory depression, if there's marked hyperchloremic acidosis that happens because we only give sodium chloride, or if there's significant lactic acidosis. I showed you this before. So known complications of treatment are hypoglycemia because of mistreatment, typically, hypokalemia or hyperkalemia because of inappropriate attention to the need of to give potassium and to monitor it appropriately. Fluid overload can happen in patients, obviously, and then somebody with severe CHF, low cardiac output with very low EF and so on, you may have to put a Swan Ganz, or you need to monitor the patient much more closely, obviously. Hyperchloremic acidosis. A little bit of hyperchloremic acidosis is expected in every patient when you give lots of saline. It doesn't cause any harm typically, only if it lowers the pH. Cerebral edema I mentioned because of overzealous lowering of extracellular fluid osmolality. ARDS seen in this condition, and patient obviously can also get thromboembolic episodes. Yes.
Why thromboembolic episodes? That's because in the increased inflammation state?
In the uncontrolled diabetic state, you have, number one, the patient, of course, is not moving very much. It's in, typically in bed. And you also have abnormal coagulation parameters. I don't know the exact mechanism. There are cytokine-induced problems in any kind of stress and infection and doses. There are in diabetics, there's some platelet dysfunction in general, and that's worse than hyperglycemia. The exact mechanism, I don't know, really. I probably should, but I don't. And the key thing is education of the patient and healthcare providers to prevent it. So that's all the slides I have. I'm open for questions. It's something well described in patients, particularly with hyperosmolar state. And again, I don't know what the mechanism, anybody knows what the mechanism is, but when people don't know the mechanism, they talk about cytokines. And so. Any other questions? Several months. That's, I think it's unusual, but it depends on the duration of hyperglycemia that was present before. After you have prolonged hyperglycemia, we see patients that run around with blood sugars of 300, 350 and have practically no symptoms because they're totally adapted to it. If you take those kind of patients and lower their blood sugar, they get symptoms of hyperglycemia. If it gets down to close to 100, and they can get blurring of vision at that point, because blurring of vision is a change in the extracellular fluid versus the lens osmolality, and because there's decreased ability to quickly exchange across the lens. So it can happen. It happens in fluctuating blood sugars, not necessarily going only up. But several months, that's extremely unusual. I don't know how to explain that. Okay, thank you.